welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Dan.
Today we're joined by semiconductor and EDA executive Jack Harding. Jack has a diverse career as a technology executive beginning at IBM with notable stops along the way, including taking place and route company Cooper & Chen Technology public. He also took the helm from Joe Costello as CEO of Cadence and most recently the founding CEO of eSilicon, which was acquired by Inphi. Jack advises industry, academia, and government on matters of technology and innovation. He is a frequent international speaker on topics of innovation, entrepreneurship, and semiconductor trends and policies. We'll be getting into some of his views on these areas in a moment, but first, Jack, please let us know how you got into semiconductors.
Well, I sort of jumped on the coattails of a bunch of IBM guys. That was sort of the earliest theme of my career. I joined IBM right out of school and stayed there long enough to realize that the second best decision I ever made was to join IBM and the first best was to leave. I was recruited to, of all places, into a boutique investment bank in Manhattan, which had been founded by a group of IBM execs. And IBM had a sort of a diversion of sorts of companies that were going into the computer leasing business. And so they would buy out leases for IBM computers and then release them under structured deals to get rates way down and effectively compete with IBM with their own machinery and buying their own maintenance. So a group of those guys went into the leasing business doing every transaction other than data processing. And they had recruited me into open up their Manhattan office, and they trained me into the banking world. And I did that for several years. I liked it very much, but I had sort of an epiphany that I was a transactor and not a creator. And my heart was in making things, you know, making product, starting companies, things like that. And the investment banking community, while very lucrative and exciting, by the way, is just it's a matchmaker trade. And while I have great respect for it, it just wasn't for me. So another group of IBMers recruited me successfully from that banking world into one of the earliest EDA companies called Zycad. And Zycad made special purpose supercomputers that were used to simulate circuitry and chips, full chips, before they were made, and you know, to prove their validity and their performance prior to going to the expensive manufacturing route. And so a long-winded way to answer your question I sort of suddenly found myself submerged into the bowels of semiconductor companies all over the world who were struggling mightily with the simulation problem, and I had a solution. I was one of the earliest employees, you know, probably like number 10, and so my job was to sell these computers into the large, you know, international conglomerates who all had semiconductor divisions at the time, and by the way, we're all vertically integrated, so we had access to all the detailed design work, and it was easy to simulate a full chip because there was no third-party IP. So overnight, my whole world changed, and we took the company public shortly thereafter, and we're on a run and end up staying there for 10 years and ultimately leaving as chief operating officer.
Yeah, I remember Mike and I worked with you as ICAT. That's a great story.
There was a lot of interesting business transactions along the way. The company sort of went into a free fall, started to collapse. The CEO and CFO were fired. And our dear friend, who we just heard the bad news, Phil Smith, was brought in as CEO. Phil and I ended up working for several years together in California. I moved out to run sales and marketing and our services business. And Phil and I got very close.
Yeah, Jack, I remember Phil very fondly as well. It's a real shame. If those who don't know, just recently, actually yesterday, Phil did pass away. And it's a great loss. It's a great loss to the industry. Phil was great at quotes and stories. The one that I remember most fondly is he would say, you know, I may not always be right, but I'm always sure. And that kind of described Phil. He was a force of nature. Don't get in his way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He said, I'm not always right, but I'm never unsure. That's right. Yes. That was his favorite line.
Yeah, it's true. We could fill up the rest of this podcast with Phil stories. Maybe we'll do that in the future.
And while we're on the Phil subject, I'll tell you, the Zycad was slow to respond to the performance gains from workstations, made by, IBM and Apollo and all these other guys, and also improvements in software in general. And each year we lost a little bit of our lead in the actual simulation business, to the point where it was clear that we're not going to dig out of that anytime soon. So I went to Phil and I said, we're grossly overstaffed. And I said, Phil, I've been here for 10 years. I love this company. I feel like I helped get it to this point, but the company doesn't need both of us. And he said, I think you're right. He said, let me think about it. And on Monday I went to work and his assistant said, hey, Phil wants to talk to you. I went in his office and Phil was at his desk sobbing. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, I thought about all weekend about what you said about us having to cut back and not needing both you and me. He goes, and I think I need to stay. I think you and several others should go. And we need to cut our costs. He said, I just can't hand you the keys right now because too many things are troubled. And it just wouldn't be fair to you and your team to take over. So I'm going to stay. And when I walked back to my desk, there was one of those little pink message slips on my desk. And it was from the head of HR from this company, as you mentioned, called Cooper & Chen Technology. And I called that number. And they said, hey, we're interested in you joining us as a CEO. So I went from parting ways with really one of my closest business friends and in many ways a mentor, and walked to my office and found my next gig, which became legendary in the legal and financial world because of the scale of its IPO and then sale to Cadence.
So Jack, when Cadence bought CCT, you ended up being the CEO of Cadence. That's got to be an interesting story.
Yeah. Joe asked me to run all the business units, that we divided them all up into five different units. And it had sort of a COO look and feel to it, but I did not have the title. And though there was still a sales force and still, all the other divisions, but we had the critical mass of all the development and the marketing. And so I had agreed to stay there for a year, and about a year or so into it, I decided, big company wasn't my cup of tea. I like the small companies. So I discussed it with my wife, and we decided we'd move back to the East Coast. And I was at our home in Vermont, and he calls me like on a Friday night and says, hey, listen, can you be in my office Sunday morning? And I said, sure, what's up? He says, well, just come on out. So I fly out to California that Sunday morning, and I get there. Joe's not there yet. 12 minutes or two later, Joe walks in. He says, come on, let's go for a walk. So we go walking around the parking lot, and he said, listen, let me cut to the chase. He said, last Wednesday, I resigned. You're the new CEO. Congratulations. So I said to him, I just bought a house in Boston, and I was good. My family's all set to move back there to the East Coast. I need to talk to my wife. He says, of course. But I said, I'll let you know in a couple of days. So 2 days later, of course, I accepted the job. And it was, the use of the old cliche, it was the fire hose.
So let's talk about eSilicon. What brought you from Cadence to eSilicon?
What cleared my mind is I got fired from Cadence. When I was now out of Cadence, I went back to doing what I always did. And I thought, I'm just going to go start another company, and I'll figure it out as I go. And so I love this idea of the fabulous ASIC company, although we had not used the term yet. The term was coined by a guy named Mike Gianfagna, who had come to me about a month after we had started the business and said, he says, Jack, he goes, I don't know if you realize this, but we have the first fabulous ASIC company in the world. And Mike had guessed. at the future and said, I think everyone's going to go this way. So anyway, that's how it all began. And off we went. We were very internet centric at the time. We tried to do many things online, from chip estimation to design and all sorts of technology and pricing. And the world wasn't quite ready for that. And while we ultimately got into it and made it a backbone of our business for many years, we really pivoted the company into what it became, which was a fabulous ASIC company. And of course, within 5 years, everyone who could had abandoned their fabs and had taken on our model. You know, Mike joined early on. We brought in a world-class technology team that I'd known for years from out of Bell Labs. And we hit it hard for 20 years. Believe it or not, it flew by, but that's how long we were at it.
Yeah, Jack, I do recall the early days. And you're right. I was driving to work one day, and it occurred to me that we were actually doing what LSI Logic did, but with a very, very different balance sheet. And that's what kind of led me to the conclusion we were a fabulous ASIC company. And then, you know, just a quick story there. I recall we launched the company actually at TechMart on an internet channel. We streamed it live worldwide when we launched the company, and we had Brian Lewis from Gartner at the time come and talk about fabulous ASIC, and he instituted coverage on the sector right from then. He was actually at Gartner and then DataQuest for many years. I hear just recently he's retired, but he was quite a friend and really promoted the idea very, very strongly. But the most interesting thing for me about East Silicon was the resilience of the company. I mean, you know, when, as you point out, when we first formed the company, there was a real hiccup in the internet and delivering the technology that way, and then the dot-com explosion basically destroyed our whole channel of delivery. And I would argue most companies go out of business when that happens, when your model doesn't work and your delivery vehicle disappears. But we didn't. We reoriented the company and did quite well as a fabulous ASIC company. And then there were some other twists and turns along the way too. You know, maybe some comments on that, Jack. It's like, what was the magic there? The company just seemed to always know when and how to repivot or refocus to keep going.
Yeah. Let me begin with what we did not have. We did not have the critical mass to fund everything we needed to do as the complexity curve was foisted upon us. You know, every time we went to a new, smaller geometry, you know, the IP got more expensive, the tape out became more expensive. You guys know this, you know, better than I do. And it was happening at a pace that we were struggling to stay current with. We had had an early strategy of, and I remember I in a EE Times interview early on, I told them that I was going to build chips at N minus one. And they said, what's that? I said, bleeding edge minus one node. That's where we're going to be. And that term actually became memorialized in the industry as a way to describe, you know, less than bleeding edge. And that was our path. And so we had large number of customers. The model got a lot of traction. We had a couple early hit records. We made a chip for a supplier of Apple for the first iPod. That was a huge hit for us. And we had other success stories along the way that effectively financed us over otherwise would have been unsustainable gaps. So, but we had this volatility in the hit rate of when the chips would actually go to production. And I think looking back, we probably even overestimated how many chips would go to production, not because we didn't understand the ratios. And so we couldn't conceive that a company would spend $50 or $100 million developing a chip, not knowing that they were going to have success. Well, it turns out there was a lot of those guys. There was a lot of companies, both startups and big companies, that would spend fortunes and years developing chips that would fail. And the number one cause of that failure was the architectural impulse to put as many features into a chip as possible. The idea was, let's put everything in so it's our chip's attractive to everybody. And well, that's how we'll justify the volumes. But of course, what would happen is that any given user of that chip would only want, say, half of the features. So they'd be buying the rest of those features and not using them. So these chips would come out, they'd always be overpriced, they'd always be over-architected. And we came to realize that the biggest winners were the ones that were had the most economic view and they were and the most efficient view of using real estate. And so we went through a period where when people would come in and say, oh, this is going to be a home run because we're God's gift to everything, we'd usually politely show them the door because we had seen that movie many times. And so that realization helped us through the middle years. What had happened though, and Mike, I'm sure you recall this because you came back into the company right around this time, we realized that we were sort of betwixt and between. Fewer and fewer foundries were around. Companies were loath to make these giant do everything chips except for the biggest companies. And we really just didn't have the IP or even some of the methodologies to do bleeding edge chips. So we had a weekend meeting with the whole staff and we sort of ended up calling it after the fact. It was our go big or go home meeting about 5 or 6 years ago, 7 probably now. And we sat down and made a list of everything we had to have to make the world's most advanced chips, period. Like not like for an ASIC company or for a fabless ASIC company, the world's most advanced chips. I mean like Intel, AMD, NVIDIA type chips. So we did all that, and that was for tools, people, IP development, acquisition of IP companies. I mean, everything. We just had this massive list, and we quite literally parsed it up among the management team and said, all right, you make this happen, you make that happen. And over the course of about 12 or even maybe 18 months, we did it all. We acquired design operations around the world. That very efficient operation, high productivity, most notably in Vietnam. We backfilled our entire IP portfolio with people doing work in Vietnam and through acquisitions of key technology like Certes. We brought on the staffs we need, some of the key expertise in package and test. And we were bringing people in from huge world-class companies who wanted to be part of this sort of like this pivot and this revolution we are going to have. So this is now at this point is kind of like eSilicon 4.0, and the subtitle for the chapter would be attacking the big guys. that was our MO. We had been together, most of us, in the leadership role since the very beginning, and we were not used to giving up, and we were certainly not used to failing. No one had ever failed, and so we went for it. When we finally started going to market, I think we had 4 of the most complex chips in the world in our hands, in packages, ready for full-scale production. And I remember meeting with some executives from the biggest companies in the world, a couple of CEOs who I'd known very well. And I pulled these chips out and threw them on the dinner table one night. And they were like, what's all this? And I said, these are chips that we have made, that we invented the packaging technology for. We've done all the work. It's got a lot of our IP, and all of these are ready for full-scale production. And one person from like one of the biggest companies in the world said, we've only done 2, you've done 4. And I realized in that moment that the team had achieved its lofty goals. And I wasn't shocked because, as I said, many, many people had been in 2 and 3 companies together, including you, Mike. And I just knew what everyone was capable of if we created the right environment and got out of their way. The whole management philosophy, the work environment, the culture, the strategy, all of these things played mightily into our success. We think of semiconductors as technology play, and rightfully, but all of that in with the wrong team, in the wrong culture, at the wrong time, that never yields a success. And so we had to change many of the things about the company, how we worked, how our communication worked, authority channels. We just went for it. And as I stand here today, we closed on the sale of the company about 15 months ago to Inphi, and of course Synopsys bought a large chunk of it as well. And, it's always a mixed feeling to hand your baby over to somebody else. We put the company in good hands. And as you know, the Inphi piece is now part of Marvell, which is even better. It was a good outcome.
Yeah, that's a great way to set the stage, Jack. for what's going to happen next. So what will you do next? What are the important trends you see on the horizon, and what opportunities do they bring?
I had planned when we sold the company a year ago, January, to take 6 or 12 months off and sort of catch my breath and do some family stuff and the usual things. And of course, 6 weeks into it, COVID hits, and that sort of cleared the mind. And so during my regeneration phase, I also had the requirement of just staying put, and I've done that. So I've had a chance to think about a lot of things. I have mixed emotions about some of the trends, to tell you the truth. And it might be because I haven't studied them sufficiently, or it's because I don't know what the impact's going to be to the industry. You know, if you look at like Bitcoin and blockchain technology, it's going to become pervasive. I don't know what that does to the fundamental economics and supply chain activity of the semiconductor industry. I'm sure the industry will work it out. Semiconductors is the top performing industry in the world by any metric. But I guess I'm just saying I'm curious about the implications there. You know, I've had several years to digest the impact of artificial intelligence and that whole broader subject. And I think that's already well into the, woven into the fabric of the semiconductor industry. And I think we've all digested the trends and the importance of all that. And we're seeing it. So, I mean, it's already becoming real. So these mega technologies and mega trends all fascinate me. And as I said, I can't think of an industry, no matter what it is, that's faster to respond to tectonic shifts in the global marketplace than the semiconductor industry. So I'm very bullish on that in general. On the other hand, I worry about the availability of younger engineers for semis here in the United States. There's so many other sexier and frankly more lucrative opportunities, and wealth can be made in much faster amount of time in other industries than can make in our industry. I just worry that we're not going to have the next generation coming along and keeping the United States on the cutting edge. I think that's going to be a big concern. And as a result, you're going to see, of course, it shift to other countries, China, India, et cetera, where electrical engineering and the associated industries are still highly populated and in demand by the young people. And so, Vietnam's a very good example of an up-and-coming marketplace where people really value the EE experience and still see semis as a bright spot. So they're the things that are on my mind. I always believe that, companies are sort of formed by having a general sense of what's happening and then jumping into the middle of it. I have sort of a Zen approach to entrepreneurship. I like being the contrarian, because in my mind, if you're doing something different from everybody else, that means you're not chasing them. And I think that's a requirement to have a successful startup. You know, if you're chasing a big guy, you're always going to be chasing the big guy. It's just a question of how much further they get in front of you before you fail. So I'm not one of these people that says you've got to have the perfect business plan and execute it exactly. At East Silicon, we had a sense of what we wanted to do, but we changed our tactics all the time. We always knew we wanted to make complex chips with a asset light business model, and do all the things we in fact end up doing. But we never said how we were going to do it every day. Not being wed to a particular way of doing things meant that we hired Renaissance people that could do many things well, that we could shift the activities of the employees on a dime, that people welcomed the ambiguity. It wasn't a, oh God, what are they doing today? It was a, this is exciting. I go to work, I never know what's gonna change. As I look into the marketplace, I am always optimistic about development of new companies, because I'm of that school where I don't believe you have to know what the company looks like exactly to start it. Right now I'm personally whittling down different markets, understanding different trends, talking to smart people I know, and maybe considering what swimming pool I jump into, and then figure out how not to drown. So we'll see. It's an exciting time, and it just gets more exciting as we go. I still want to continue to do the things I love to do, And that's the biggest motivation for me, bar everything else.
Yeah, Mike and I have talked about this quite a bit. It's probably the most exciting time to be in semiconductors or electronics in all of our careers. So, we're happy to be a part of it. So this is probably a good time to stop. I want to thank Jack for spending time with us and sharing his thoughts and the history lesson of EDA and ASIC. That was excellent. Mike and I were in the middle of this, so we have even more appreciation for it. And thanks to our listeners, and hopefully we will meet you again soon, Jack.
It was my pleasure, and congratulations on the success of SemiWiki. And by the way, for all the great work you guys do, I consider you both to be at the hub of some of the best communication in the industry, and I'm always proud to be associated with you. So thank you as well.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.